string of hairs. Hello, this is Fred Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. Our first story today, no appointments, no nurses, no private insurance needed. Written by Helen Oyang. On a road in Aurora, Colorado, lined with used car dealers and pawn shops, sits a tan, low-rise building called Mango House. Inside, among international food stalls and ethnic clothing shops, is a family medicine clinic that serves a largely refugee and immigrant community. Improbably, the clinic makes enough money to sustain itself and pay staff well without relying on grants or donations, and it does so through Medicaid. The prevailing wisdom is that Medicaid is a losing proposition for health facilities, an insurance program so stingy that many can't afford to take it. Some of those that do essentially segregate Medicaid patients into separate clinics. Here, Medicaid is preferred. Because the clinic relies so heavily on that program, I expected that the Trump administration's upcoming Medicaid cuts might force Mango House to close or pare back. Instead, when I spoke recently with the clinic's founder and owner, P.J. Parmar, they were far from his mind. Medicaid's practices and patients' coverage already fluctuate enough that he and his staff are used to weathering such unpredictable forces. Even if 15% of his patients fell off Medicaid because of the cuts, his practice would be fine, he said, showing me his calculations. Parmar is a family physician who opened the practice, officially named Artis Family Medicine, but now better known by its location inside Mango House, in 2012. He wanted to re-engineer how a clinic could run, designing systems that maximized efficiency and ease of access. For starters, Parmar eliminated scheduled appointments, which he called an exercise in craziness. In theory, appointments ensure that people don't have to wait long to see their doctor. But Parmar found scheduling to be so inherently erratic. Some patients need only a few minutes, others half an hour. Many don't show up at all. That he could see more patients while keeping wait time short by simply having them walk in. On the Wednesday I was there, the practice hummed along. Medical assistants from Nepal, Myanmar, Somalia, and Afghanistan greeted patients. The average wait time hovered around 10 minutes. Even during the Monday afternoon rush, Parmar said, waits rarely exceed 30 minutes. Most days of the year, it's open all but five. The clinic is staffed with three clinicians, a mix of doctors and nurse practitioners, who together see about 100 patients. Each provider has a dedicated exam room arranged how they like, so they don't waste time hunting for supplies or shuttling between spaces. They escort patients from the waiting room and perform vital signs themselves. The clinic doesn't employ nurses. Lower-cost medical assistants handle routine tasks, such as giving shots and drawing blood. The providers see patients in order of arrival. Of course, some patients still have favorites, so staff will mark any preferences when they check in. In American medicine, short appointment times are often a cause for complaint. But from what I observed at the Mango House Clinic, the ease of access, rather than undue pressure on clinicians, seemed to keep many visits brief. An older woman Parmar has long cared for came in with a cough, and even as he was writing her a prescription, she asked, "Can I go now?" She told him that if she didn't feel better in a week, she'd just walk into the clinic again. Parmar also deliberately streamlines clinic notes by encouraging his providers to avoid the common habit of copying and pasting blocks of obsolete or redundant information in favor of quick updates that can be scanned easily at subsequent visits. When I described this practice to a soft Bitten, a Harvard professor and primary care researcher. He told me it likely helps clinicians see more patients without feeling overextended. Small efficiencies add up for both staff and patients. The morning I was there, a Nepalese man, Gam Sunawar, chose to fill his prescription for blood pressure medication at the clinic's in-house pharmacy, even though he'd need to cut the pills in half. Better to walk out with what he needed than to wait hours at his neighborhood pharmacy for pills in a specific dose. The pharmacy sometimes operates at a loss, but it helps keep patients loyal to the clinic. Clinicians also hand out dozens of over-the-counter medications and reading glasses for free. Patients sometimes ask the clinic to complete immigration paperwork. Parmar keeps the service cheap and less tedious for clinic workers, with a computer formula he wrote that pulls vaccine data from the state website into federal immigration forms with one click. The clinic accepts anyone, but about 70% of its patients are on Medicaid. Almost all of the rest are seen for free. Parmar's two billers are very adept with Medicaid, the only insurer they have to master, unlike others juggling with different health plans' whims. Parmar himself rattles off Medicaid billing codes like it's second nature. Here, private insurance is not desirable because it can be difficult to get companies to pay up. During my visit, when one patient, a 9-year-old, was registered with a commercial insurance, Parmar pored over its payment sheet without making much sense of it. In the amount of time we've looked at this, we could have seen the girl already, he said. The clinic would bill her insurance, but if the insurer demanded more paperwork, which it likely would, the claim would be abandoned. The clinic's ethos, just take care of patients, is both an ethical imperative and a practical tactic to keep the clinic running at full speed. Medicaid patients often cycle off coverage because they forget to renew, or their paperwork never reaches them. Parmar called this the churn of Medicaid. Many patients have no idea what their insurance is, a status so common that staff use the term in the clinic's tracking spreadsheet. The staff will try to figure it out, but at some point it's not worth haggling over insurance and demanding documents from patients. Pressing for payment could humiliate people who often arrive with their extended families, Parmar explained, and in a community this close-knit, that could mean losing dozens of patients, including many of the Medicaid patients who keep the clinic afloat. And for a practice that relies on Medicaid, survival is ultimately a volume game, Parmar said. That phrase would usually sound ominous in healthcare. Seeing more patients often means rushed visits and burned out staff. But the clinic does well on the state's performance indicators and, from what I observed, is set up so that patients who need extra time get it. Tigest Desta, one of the nurse practitioners, spent the better part of an hour trying to figure out the vaccination status of a child who had just arrived from Ethiopia, for instance. The clinic has had a few lean years in which Parmar lost money, particularly when he bought the old J.C. Penney building where Mango House is now located, but he has more than made it back. The practice's profits are considerably higher than the average family physician's. Parmar told me he puts much of the money back into Mango House. He opened his QuickBooks for me, but asked that I not publicly share the numbers. This year, he significantly raised staff salaries. Several years ago, he added a dental practice, though it has yet to break even. When I first heard about Mango House, I was curious whether its model could be duplicated elsewhere. For one, it seemed to offer a glimpse of the kind of health care Americans might experience if the country ever moved toward a single-payer system. I also found its operations appealing, particularly in that it seemed to focus on what mattered to patients and doctors rather than to administrators. The simple fact that it's an independent clinic may be an asset. Some studies have found that physician-owned clinics achieve greater cardiovascular outcomes while also being associated with lower burnout for staff. More and more primary care docs work for these big health systems, and they're not that independent business owners who are better at seeing more patients and recouping their work on the billing side. Ativ Mehrotra, the chair of health policy at Brown, told me, "Parmar can adjust on the fly. He needed an extra provider on those busy Monday afternoons starting the week after I visited because, as he put it, there's no committee looking over me." But independence also can seem like an idiosyncrasy or merely choosing a different corners to cut. At Mango House, patients don't change into gowns except for intimate exams, and a patchwork of multilingual staff, family members, and neighbors handles interpretation, an approach that experts oppose because these unofficial translators might not explain medical terms properly or could compromise patient privacy. Parmar countered that he retired his remote interpreting service after finding that patients preferred their family and community members, who also often know details they themselves neglect to mention. As Catherine Baker, the provost and health economist at the University of Chicago, told me, often things that work in one setting may not work in another. In at least 16 other states, Medicaid pays as well or better than it does in Colorado, which could make replication feasible if clinics could get the same volume. But not every state allows medical assistants to give injections, erasing that cost savings. Other patient populations may be more litigious than those served by the clinic, which could pressure providers to order extra tests and unnecessary referrals. Neither Baker nor Bitten, the Harvard professor, has studied Mango House, but both see the clinic's strengths as tailoring care to the local community. Bitten thought it probably shared features with a few bright spots he has studied, places defined by a sort of radical simplicity, he said, where the clinicians essentially work within a single-payer system to serve a defined community of patients. Yet that may be exactly what makes Mango House tough to replicate. Parmar himself acknowledged that the clinic's casual, community-like style might not jibe with every population. He doesn't bother with satisfaction surveys anyway. For him, the true measure is how many patients return. For now, it's more than enough. Our second story, the internet is going to break again. This is written by Will Gottsagen. Everything is in the cloud now, except the cloud is a real place, and it's in Northern Virginia. Rows and rows of servers stacked in Amazon-owned warehouses across Ashburn, Haymarket, McNair, Manassas, and Sterling make up a chunk of the infrastructure for the modern internet. Equipment as crucial as railway tracks and the electric grid. When a technical issue disrupted operations at those facilities, it was enough to temporarily crash the internet for users around the world. The incident marked at least the third time in the past 5 years that Amazon Web Services' Northern Virginia facilities contributed to a widespread internet outage. This time, more than 1,000 sites and services were affected, according to Down Detector, costing companies an estimated hundreds of billions of dollars. Venmo users were locked out of their payments, and international banks experienced major blips in their service. People struggled to book urgent doctor appointments and couldn't access their Medicare benefits. Snapchat and Reddit were down, as were Instagram and Hulu. Ring paused their doorbell cameras. ChatGPT stopped answering. Some unfortunate customers of 8 Sleep, which sells AI-powered, temperature-changing mattresses, woke to bright strobe lights or an absolutely freezing bed, per testimony on X. Throughout most of yesterday, the connective tissue of modern life seemed to be under threat. A reminder that the internet is physical, fallible, and heavily reliant on just a few massive companies. The modern web owes that fragility in part to the cloud. In the pre-cloud age, setting up a website meant buying physical servers, procuring software licenses, and writing foundational code from scratch. This do-it-yourself approach was both extremely expensive and time-consuming. The basic proposition of the cloud is, what if you didn't have to do any of that? Amazon and its competitors own the servers and pre-write the code so customers don't have to. When developers lease infrastructure from cloud providers, they get to leave the cumbersome work of maintenance to someone else. The trade-off is ownership for accessibility, upfront costs for monthly fees, and it has proved extremely attractive. Adoption in the corporate world has been nearly universal. Amazon spearheaded the rush to the cloud in the late 2000s when it began building the warehouses that now house much of the modern internet. Thanks to that first mover advantage, it still dominates today. Amazon controls an estimated 30% of the global market for cloud computing, while its competitors Microsoft and Google have captured 20 and 13% respectively. Because the actual servers are consolidated under a handful of companies, so are the potential points of failure, not to mention the profits. Unlike the highways that crisscross the United States, which are built and maintained by government programs, physical data conduits are built and maintained by corporations. The internet is often understood as a free and open resource, but it is controlled by a small group of digital landowners. Last July, a single cybersecurity firm caused an internet-wide meltdown that grounded planes and interrupted financial services around the world. Jonathan Cantor, a former top antitrust regulator in the Biden administration, told me such disruptions help society understand the magnitude of the power, the magnitude of the reach that certain companies have. It doesn't just affect one commercial interest, it affects the entire country. Amazon's dominance is compounded by the nested structure of the internet. One hyperlink leads to another, which leads to another, which is at some point probably leads back to Amazon. At issue with Amazon's Virginia servers might affect Amazon products globally and any websites that interact with Amazon-backed services. A business that doesn't rely on Amazon for its services might still be entwined with another business that does. There are ways out of the centralization trap, but they come with their own problems. Rumble, the streaming service that has become a home for those deplatformed elsewhere, has an AWS alternative of its own. The issue is that Rumble is also linked to inflammatory right-wing causes that could potentially pose reputational risk for major companies looking to use its cloud services. Urbit, another attempt at decentralizing the internet that has generated buzz over the past few years, was founded by the software developer and far-right provocateur, Curtis Yarvin, who has openly advocated for an American monarchy. No truly decentralized alternative has so far come close to the scale of AWS, which has dramatically outspent and outperformed its competition. And at this point, new challengers may find it too hard to catch up. True decentralization is also incredibly difficult to achieve in cloud computing and beyond. Consider crypto, a form of digital currency originally designed to deliver freedom from the centralized authority of banks and governments. That was the idea, anyway. In practice, this roughly $4 trillion industry is very much beholden to the centralized internet, as well as to Wall Street and Congress. Coinbase, which also went down yesterday amid the AWS outage, is in some ways the antithesis of what crypto's libertarian thought leaders imagined. Like many other crypto companies, it discovered that centralization is the price of doing business. Amazon doesn't publicize the existence of its Virginia data centers, and most customers may not even know they exist. But as a steward of the internet, the company has accrued an enormous amount of influence over our lives. How we access our money, how we seek medical help, even how some people get a good night's sleep. Tech outages happen, but under our current system, a bad day for Amazon can be a bad day for everyone. Next, It's Not Enough to Read Orwell by Shirley Lee. George Orwell was dying when he wrote 1984 in the late 1940s on the desolate island of Jura in Scotland's Inner Hebrides. Tuberculosis ravaged his body, and typing thousands of words a day only weakened him further. His skin flaked off, blisters burst across his throat. Feverish and emaciated, he endured painful procedures to support his failing lungs. But these treatments were too late. Eventually, in 1950, Orwell succumbed to the disease. Close-ups of microscopic tuberculosis bacteria fill the screen in the opening minutes of the documentary Orwell, 2 plus 2 equals 5. Images as bold and unnerving as what follows. Directed by the Oscar-nominated filmmaker Raoul Peck, the film examines the idea popularized by 1984, that blatant falsehoods can, through propaganda, be accepted as truth. That conceit, along with Orwell's state of mind during his final months, has been scrutinized for decades by high school students, biographers, and other documentarians. But Peck builds out a bigger argument using material provided by the Orwell estate, including the writer's letters, essays, and diary entries, to trace the authoritarian tactics that can suppress truth and lay out what he sees as a disturbing pattern, one of wide-scale complacency in the decades after Orwell's death. Generations of readers have recognized the prescient warnings of 1984, yet according to Peck's film, recognizing that reality can resemble Orwell's dystopian masterpiece has led to numbness rather than meaningful change. The tuberculosis bacteria motif underscores this idea. To compare authoritarianism's rise to an infection is perhaps obvious, but as the microbes spread across the screen, the visual becomes almost hypnotic, and, as Peck recently told me, akin to how dictators overwhelm people's ability to determine fact from fiction. Peck grew up under multiple authoritarian regimes. At 8 years old, he and his family fled Haiti after Franco Duvalier, the dictator known as Papa Doc, began his rule. Around the same time that his family moved to the Republic of the Congo, that country's first democratically elected prime minister was assassinated. The following coup placed the despot Mobutu Sese Seko in power. To Peck, Papa Doc and Mobutu Bhutu followed the same playbook. They attack intelligence. They attack universities. They attack science. They attack the press, he said. They attack every institution that can be a bulwark against them. Those memories shape Peck's approach to Orwell, 2 plus 2 equals 5. A more traditional exploration of Orwell's fiction might turn to interviews with scholars of his work to unpack his resonance. Peck instead explores the idea cinematically, as he did in I Am Not Your Negro, his 2016 deconstruction of James Baldwin's work. He recreates an impressionistic collage featuring scenes derived mostly from Orwell's writings, which are recited by the actor Damian Lewis, or from relevant archival footage. As the document in the documentary Peck said, is intended to convey his frustration that Orwell's name has too often be, been flattened into an adjective, and 1984 into mere speculative fiction. In one scene from Orwell, 2 plus 2 equals 5, Apple's well-known Super Bowl ad, in which a model hurls a sledgehammer at a Big Brother broadcast, plays on a giant billboard above a busy street, as passersby completely ignore it. Perhaps in an effort to unflatten Orwell's warnings, the film points out what it sees as it parallels to newspeak, the uncanny English used throughout the articulation of abstract concepts. Newspeak uses the word plus good. A more insidious example would be calling any ideas that go against the ruling party thought crime. Peck argues that some world leaders have seemed to embrace the practice of twisting words. In one sequence, he displays a modern glossary of terms, peacekeeping operations, campaign finance, illegals, that he implies obfuscate thornier realities. While constructing the documentary, Peck thought of Orwell as a fighting companion, he told me, a guide rather than an encyclopedia of insights to pull from. He structured the film according to three tenets of the ruling government in 1984. War is peace, ignorance is strength, and freedom is slavery. A graphic charting the slew of banned books in the United States illustrates the power of ignorance, while a montage of security cameras in public spaces underlines the notion of freedom as an illusion. The film, as a result, can feel overstuffed, but even when he incorporates discordant images, Peck keeps a close eye on Orwell's vision. If anything, Peck hoped the film's density and wide scope would illuminate how frequently the past's most painful moments repeat themselves. Knowing that many dictators have come to power through familiar means isn't enough to stop them, the film argues. A democratic system needs to be renewed and reinforced every day, Peck said, through a commitment to truth. Such pursuits may be the only way to shake off intellectual paralysis, the only way to remember what 2 plus 2 actually equates. That last story had to be edited for time, as we've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.